It is indeed fitting that on Founders Day we have the synodical president with us as we celebrate the anniversary of the founding of Concordia Seminary. The Reverend Dr. A.L. Berry is the 10th president of the synod. Prior to becoming president, Dr. Berry served 10 years as president of the synod's Iowa District East. He also served as the executive secretary for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Board for Missions from 1975 to 1977. He was born in Woodbine, Iowa. He attended Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota, Concordia Theological Seminary in Springfield, Illinois, the Orthodox Lutheran Seminary, Minneapolis, and was ordained in 1956 after finishing his pastoral training through the Thiensville, Wisconsin Seminary of the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Church. In 1960, he requested a transfer of pastoral membership to the Missouri Synod. He has a Master of Theology degree from Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, and in 1986 was awarded an honorary Doctor of Divinity degree by Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Berry and his wife Jean have 3 children and 2 grandchildren. We welcome on this Founders Day the President of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. A.L. Berry.
Thank you. It is good to be here this morning, and especially on a day that has become meaningful to you as a group of people as Founders Day. I just happened to go up into Pritzloff Hall before I came over here to the assembly area, and I walked past this august group of presidents, one painting after another painting there. I saw CFW first of all, and he and I had a little bit in common, not only in theology, but in hairstyle. But it is good to be here. I also do appreciate the invitation to come and spend a little time with you. Already early on, the invitation was extended to me, and it was not possible for me to accept because of some other commitments that were in the schedule. But at last, we were able to make it, and last week, I was able to meet with the faculty here, had a great meeting with them, and today, with you, the student body. I might say that I have also been at our sister seminary up in Fort Wayne. I was there in September already for the opening of that seminary. Have been back just once for a slight meeting there, and will be going there shortly in February as well as in January for the selection of the new president of our Fort Wayne Seminary. And I really want to spend a good deal of time out in the church, not only at the seminaries and at the colleges, but I also want to spend a good deal of time simply out with the people of God. I've been sort of zigzagging back and forth across the Senate, in addition to keeping papers moving across my desk, talking with the people of God on a very simplistic subject, I suppose, a casual visit with your new synodical president. And in many respects, I will want to cover much of that material here today. What I'd really like to do is to take about 30 minutes to talk with you a little bit on a casual visit with your new synodical president. Then I'd like to open it up for 30 minutes and give you a hefty chance of time to ask questions of me or share observations with me or concerns or whatever it may be. And in that way, I think we'll perhaps fulfill the goal of this Founders Day gathering. We did have the privilege of having Dr. Johnson and also Dean Hempelman at the last Council of Presidents meeting, and they shared with us the review that they are making of the curriculum here at the seminary. I know that the men assembled there were very appreciative of the report that was given, and I think since then you've also met with the JAO task force and shared the same information with them, and Jack, in talking with me, also said they're doing a good job. So let me spend just a little time, first of all, talking with you on the question that many people ask me, how's it going? And then after that, I'd like to talk even more concerning the emphases that I hope to be holding before our church body during the next several years. One of you young men out in the hall said, "Are you going to announce any new doctrines today?" No, I thought I would save that to next time. It was as Gene and I were driving to the Pittsburgh convention that my wife asked me a question I think every wife has a right to ask you. What do you think is going to happen there? And I really had no idea other than that I could say back to her in all sincerity, I think as we have trusted ourselves into the hands of the Lord in days past, this is also a time where we simply place ourselves again into the hands of the Lord and let His will be done. If the convention would have decided by a small majority or a big majority that I would have the privilege of staying in Iowa District East and serving the people of God there as their district president for the years to come, that would have been certainly a joyous decision, because we have enjoyed working with the good people and the pastors of the Iowa District East for some 15 years now. And we felt that if the convention, on the other hand, decided that in the years directly ahead, I should be asked to serve the Lord and serve our beloved church body in the capacity of the presidency of Synod, here too God would lead and bless. As I've said to many people, the statement which I made, the very brief acceptance statement which I made directly following the election, has sort of electrified a lot of people's thoughts all across the church. And maybe you will recall reading it or hearing it. It was, "Keep the message straight, Missouri, and get the message out, Missouri." First of all, keep the message straight, Missouri. And I'll talk more about this a little bit later in my sharings with you. We as a church body cannot afford at this point in time or ever in the history of our church of becoming ashamed of the confessional Lutheran theology that has marked us down through the years. As I find myself reaching up on the shelf and pulling off books of some of the great giants of our church who have led us in Christ, such men as Walther, Fritz, Pieper, Steckhardt, Engelder, and the list can go on and on, we have been fantastically blessed by God in that kind of leadership. And now, in the present day and age, as we come into the conclusion of this century and begin a new century in the Lord, now is not the time for Missouri to become ashamed of her confessional theology or that for which she has stood down through the years. But the other side of the coin is that Missouri dare not, absolutely dare not, become a cocoon theology type of church. And by that I mean is to take our theology and to wrap it up in a cocoon. Rather, we in Missouri must become fully aware of what a blessing we have in this conviction, this theology that has been handed to us down through the years based on the Word. And we must come out of the cocoon and let our wings spread in the full sunlight of God and fly in mission outreach to the world. Again and again, as I talk with the mission staff at the International Center, as I talk with former missionaries, I had just two of them in this past week in my office talking with me, they say there are open doors all across the world where we as a church body can not only reach out to those who have not yet heard the Lord's name, but reach out to people who have and do not have the prized theology that we do, and be a blessing to them and to our Lord in mission and in ministry. So keep the message straight, Missouri, and get the message out, Missouri. I shared with your faculty as I drove back from Pittsburgh. Jean had to fly ahead of me back home because she's an RN and she was docketed to work that weekend. That gives you a lot of time to do some thinking and a lot of time to do some heavy praying in the Lord. But the prayer that I remember the most was the one that went through my mind and I suppose across my lips the following Sunday after Jean and I got back to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I had received the sacrament together with my fellow members at King of Kings. I had thanked God in my prayers for the gift of assurance of forgiveness as found in the sacrament. And then I remember saying, "And God, I would ask but one thing of you, that you would be with me in the years ahead and that you would make me a blessing to this, our church." Already at the time that I became district president 10 years before, and I guess I need to tell you I should have been praying it long before that, and when you brother pastors or you professors are here, I would sure hope that you would pick this up very, very early in your ministries as seminarians going out into the parish ministry. About 10 years before, when I became district president, I began to pray every day, "And God, give me the wisdom to lead your people aright." Now, you know the source of that prayer. But I believe it is a prayer that not just district presidents or synodical presidents or district or synodical staff people should pray. I believe that every parish pastor all across this church should daily turn to God and genuinely ask, Lord, give me the wisdom to lead your people aright. So in addition to that prayer that for the past 10 years had gone across my lips to the Lord, I now have daily added, and be with me, God, and make me a blessing to our church. For there is nothing that I desire more than that God would be with me and use me so that I might truly be a blessing to our church in the years ahead. Well, I talked about the changes in life that all at once began to happen. I shared with your faculty the fact that what was for me as a district president, 17 to 19 letters a day that needed to be answered, sometime down around 10, all at once jumped to 50 to 60 letters a day. Well, needless to say, your secretary begins to look at you and you start dictating 60 responses in one day. I remember the day she came in and she says, I think we've hit an all-time high. We hit 89 today. And I dictated often into the evenings. But I would have to tell you that that correspondence has reached an even higher level. And that is a result of when I came into the St. Louis office at 1333 and the first article of the witness, I made a plea to the church that I might have prayer partners all across this church who would also pray God be with him and make him a blessing to our church. And I need to tell you that at one point in time, the correspondence coming from the field following the first article reached 160 letters a day. All of those letters were responded to. But from one end of the church, from the east to the west, from the north to the south, I heard men and women and young people and aged beginning to say, you can count on it, Al. You will be in our prayers. I sort of like to talk about one letter that I received, and I received some letters that were rather pointed. I remember one man wrote and said something like this. He says, I didn't vote for you at Pittsburgh, and I wouldn't vote for you if there were 10 more Pittsburghs. But then he went on to say, but I do want you to know that I will be praying for you and asking that God will use you for healing and for the strengthening of the ties that bind us together within Missouri. I wrote back to him and I said, you know, God bless you, brother. I think you need to know I respect you for saying I didn't vote for you then and I wouldn't vote for you in 10 more Pittsburghs. But I respect you equally as much for saying, but I will sure now pray for you that God would use you in our church and bless you as you serve us. There were three things that seemed to come in much of the early correspondence, and much of it centered around, we want a church body that once again really starts moving ahead in missions. We want a church body that is marked by complete financial disclosure and openness and reporting. And we want a church body where there is a calming of the waters, and once again we sense, as a basis of God's word, blessings of the Spirit, that we sense unity and harmony and peace among us. I would have wished that two more or three more emphases would have appeared in many of the letters, like lead us more into the word and make us more people-centered, but they weren't there. But I'll talk more about those under the emphases. The second article that went out in the next Lutheran Witness, I talked about a church body that needed to be much more people-centered, people-concerned, people-sensitive, a church body that is not just concerned in program, 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 materials, 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 structure, 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 that places a high value on program, but always asks the three questions that I think every program must go through. One, is it needed? Two, is it faithful to the scriptures? And three, is it people-centered? Is it people-centered? I want you to know that the second, you might call, wave of heavy correspondence came as a result of the second article, as people all across this church began to write to me. They didn't know me from Adam, but they wrote to me and they said, oh, please emphasize that we as a church body must be a people-centered church. I remember one pastor's wife writing me, and then she called me. She says, I don't know you, but I need someone to talk to. She said, I became involved with another man in the congregation, and I know it was wrong. And this sexual involvement went on for quite some time before it became apparent to the congregation. It's created a great deal of distress in our parish, and I think my husband will more than likely have to leave. I have a suspicion it'll even strain our marriage for years to come. And when she called me then, after I had written to the first letter, she said to me, "But President Barry, please tell me that I am forgiven." Over the phone, she said, "I know that I did wrong. I know that, like when you rob a bank, you have to pay the price, and I will have to pay the price. But please, President Barry, won't someone just tell me I'm forgiven?" I could hear her tears on the other end, and I would be less than honest if I didn't tell you that my eyes became very moist. And I told her to wrap her arms around herself and hug herself tight and tell herself, "God does love you, and you are forgiven in Jesus Christ." Well, I could go on, I would imagine, for an hour, telling you one instance after another instance after another instance, divorce, single parents, people losing loved ones to cancer, and the list goes on, of hurting people. And somehow, we as a church must recognize that the Master's ministry, as you find it in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as it unfolds, if there's anything you see there, it is people-centered ministry. It centers in the lives of people. And the reason that you as seminarians are here is in order that you might relate to people, be trained to relate to people, God's redeemed people, hurting people, wandering people, dying people, sick people, but people. And that emphasis must again be felt keenly across our church if we're truly to be a blessing in the Lord. Well, I guess that takes us to the seven emphases that I would like to just quickly run by you, elaborating more on some and less on others. The first emphasis that I have tried to sound to the church is, Missouri, we need to be much more in the Word than we presently are. If there was anything I sensed, both in my own life, but then when I became district president in the lives of my parish pastors, is that often a parish pastor out there in the field finds himself in the Word to crank out a sermon, in the Word to get a devotion, in the Word to do a Bible study, in the Word for this, but not in the Word simply from the standpoint of the quiet time that he needs in Christ to let the Word speak to him and talk back to God in prayer. And I have a suspicion that seminarians, you might even find that the lion's share of your being in the Word is being in the Word to get a class done, being in the Word to get an assignment fulfilled, being in the Word to get a sermon prepared for the homiletics prof. If I leave nothing else with you today, it is the encouragement that you not neglect another aspect of being in the Word that you as seminarians need to do early on and hang on to it tight, and that is being in the Word just for your own personal life in Jesus Christ. Al Berry spends 45 minutes every morning early on in the Word. I roll out at 5:30. And that is some of the prime time of the day for me. I don't tell you that in order that I can toot a horn or something like that, but I tell you that because that is what you need also to do sometime during the day in order that God and you might grow together closer in the Word. And undoubtedly, you're going to have to encourage your lay people to do the same. I believe I shared with the seminary profs here, my father was not always a Christian. In fact, my father was very opposed to the Christian faith. I can remember many a battle that took place in our home because mother wanted to raise her two sons in the faith of the Lord Jesus Christ and was willing way back when to drive 14 miles to a church, a German Lutheran church as it were, where she could get the job done. Even when at age 21, when I was 21, Dad became a Christian, he never was in the Word. And it wasn't until he was 65 years of age that Dad really started being in the Word. And I will never forget the time that I went home to visit with him and had a devotion with Dad, and I talked with Dad, and began to cry, and I said, "What's wrong, Dad?" And he said, "Nothing. It's only fathers can do." I said, "Come on, Dad, what's wrong?" He said, "Al, why did I wait until I was 65 years of age to be in the Word?" I'm going to tell you, you're going to go out to congregations where better than 90% of the people are going to fit that category. And they're going to have to see in you as young pastors and middle-aged pastors and even older pastors in Christ that you are in the Word. And they'll sense it in your life. They'll be able to tell whether you are or whether you aren't. And you won't be able to deceive them for a moment whether you are. But then seeing what a value it is in your personal life and in the life of your family, then you will have a foothold, a ground from which to say to them, "Brothers and sisters in Christ, be in the Word, be in the Word, be in the Word." And you will watch your congregation blossom mightily the more they are in God's almighty Spirit-filled Word. I mentioned your families. We raised our family, and I think we went through the same thing that everybody else does when it comes to devotions, especially when they start getting into 7th and 8th grade and going on into high school. You know, somebody's got to run off to an athletic event, and somebody... I talked recently with a pastor's wife out in the Northwest District, and she said, "I was raised in a parsonage back in western Iowa, and Dad always insisted that we would have devotions together, and we kids, we moaned and we groaned and we did all those kinds of things that you do. But," she said, "when I stood by Dad's casket at his funeral, I remember saying, 'Thanks, Dad. Thanks for being determined that we kids would be in the Word. Thanks, Dad, for the family devotions we had together. Thanks, Dad.'" The second emphasis I've already dealt at some great length: a church body that is people-centered. Boy, how I wish this morning I could go on for 45 minutes giving you illustration after illustration. This past weekend, I was standing in the social hall as a lady came up to me. She'd read again the article in The Witness. She was in the process of a husband who was running away with some other woman. A divorce was ensuing, and she began to cry. And many people in the social hall looked over there and then quickly turned and looked away. And as she stood there crying, she says, "Oh, how I need someone to talk to at this point in my life." Hurting people. Hurting people. Hurting people. And God give to us in Missouri a renewed determination not just to crank out materials and crank out programs and crank out great emphases, but God give to us in Missouri a renewed determination to be so people-centered that the world across and our people alike will know that we are that kind of a church. Third, an emphasis in missions, both at home and throughout the world. Again, I shared with your seminary professors that one of the things that has been a real joy for me over the last year and a half, and I wish I could tell you that it had gone back the last 10 and a half years, is I've endeavored every day to find one person with whom I can simply talk with about my faith. Now, I'm not batting 1,000. I'm still way above 500. I've got it to get done yet today. I would have to say that when I laid that challenge on the people in the Iowa District East and then placed it on myself, I didn't know how much fun I was going to have in just talking with people about my faith. When you finally get out into the ministry, a lot of the work that you'll be doing will have a certain numerical ring to it, like talking with someone in order that you might eventually get them into St. John's Happy Town. That's unfortunate. Oh, I want to see your congregations grow. I want to see the whole Senate grow numerically. But there's something that we need to have grow much more than just the numerical numbers of Missouri, and that is the men and women and pastors, you and me, finding those opportunities day after day where we'll never impact on the numerical growth of this church body one whit, but where we can, as it were, come up to someone and tell them the great things that God has done for us in Jesus Christ, and saying, "What he's done for me, he wants to do for you." I shared some observations with your faculty, and I didn't share one of them, I don't believe, but one I've had the opportunity. I find flying is a neat way. I flew out to New England. Boy, when you're in 7A and somebody's in 7C, they just can't unbuckle and get out. You know, they've got to stay. And I was flying. I was flying to Denver quite a while back, and I had at a Council of Presidents meeting from the family bookstore out in Chesterfield, just picked up this nice new checkbook style, New Testament. And it had a very good leather cover on it. And I thought, well, I can spend that, you know. $17.95, and I was so proud of my $17.95 Bible. And now I'm starting, and it's about a week and a half later, I'm flying from Cedar Rapids to Denver. And as I'm going, I find myself sitting again in the airplane. In the middle is a lady, a mother, and next to her is a little girl sitting next to the window. They're going out to Denver to visit Grandpa and Grandma, and I said, well, that's going to be fun, and she says, not really. And so I said, oh. That's the typical answer, oh. And she said, well, she says, it's all my fault, because you see, I'm in a divorce, and I have to go someplace while the thing is being resolved, and the divorce is my fault, too, because I was having an affair with two different men at the same time that I was married to my husband. I said, oh. Well, as we talked, it just seemed so natural for me to pull out my $17.95 Bible and take her into the account of the woman at the well. And so I did. And you know that woman on this plane, she just sits there and she looks at my Bible with the most covetous eyes. And as I watch her looking at my Bible, I think, God, you aren't asking me to give up my $17. And she just sat there and kept looking at that Bible. And the more we talked, I kind of got an idea what God wanted. And so I gave her my $17.95 Bible. I wish I could tell you when I got off at Stapleton, I picked up my suitcase and said, thanks, God, for giving me the right to give away my Bible. I didn't have that feeling. But you're going to say, well, how did you get it back? It was about a month after that, all at once through the mail, here comes my $17.95 Bible. And I had forgotten that I had written in the front of it, if found, please return to. But the thing that was so interesting, the woman said she had gone to a Lutheran church. She didn't say any denomination, you know, whether it was Elk or Missouri or what have you. She'd met the pastor, talked there. She had found herself. She had a Bible of her own. And the letter that she wrote to me ended with, I thought, the neatest thing. She said, I hope that you will have a chance to give this Bible away many times in future flights. Why do I tell you this? I tell you that already now, you as seminarians need to start opening your eyes and looking for people around you with whom you can share your faith. Maybe it's a waitress at a restaurant. Maybe it's a person at a Jiffy Lube, and I'm citing cases where I've done it. Maybe it's the barber. I still go to barbers, really. I saw in New England, my barber shop, it said, haircuts for less. And I assume that means less hair, you know. But anyway, find those places where you simply can tell someone what your faith means to you and do it now. Start now. Get in the pattern now. And if there's anything you're going to hear from one side of Missouri to the other as I zigzag back and forth, it's brother pastors, it's lay people. Look for those opportunities where you can share your faith and just lay it out and say what God did for me in Jesus Christ, he wants to do also for you. Closely coupled to that, you will hear me as an emphasis surely pushing world missions. I need to tell you that we dropped from about 400 overseas world missionaries about 20 years back to the present time where we have 188, of which in the 188, the missionary personnel at the International Center is included in that number. Now that's not forward in missions, Missouri. And somehow we as a church body, and Glenn O'Shoney tells me we're programmed now to start moving again. He said, you get me the men, you get me the workers, you get me the dollars, and we have the open doors where we can go in. And once again, we in Missouri have to reverse that downward cycle and start it up in an upward cycle and let it climb and let it climb and let it keep right on climbing, because if there's anything I hear from the east to the west to the north to the south of this church body, it's we want to be a church body in missions. we really want to be. And you're going to hear me again and again challenging us to be just that. Fourth emphasis, and I'm watching my watch here, trusting, because I want to be sure we keep you a good 30 minutes here. Fourth emphasis is a church body that is not ashamed of our confessional Lutheran theology. I think we in Missouri, we're kind of slipping into the rut of becoming a little ashamed of being Missouri. We kind of heard ourselves saying, you know, maybe what we in Missouri need to do is to take these doctrines that have encumbered us and scrape them off like barnacles off the side of the ship, and then Missouri will really be able to cut it through the water. That is not the approach for Missouri. The approach for us is to pull to the top of the staff the flag that we have stood under proudly, thankfully, before God, and with that then cruise on into the seas. Now is absolutely not the time for us to blush, to fumble in our words about what we are confessionally as a church body. Five, a church body that also very clearly deals with the entire question of the universal priesthood of believers and the office of the public pastoral ministry. I have a suspicion that many of you have already sensed that within the church there's a real struggle going on in this office of the public pastoral ministry, and that right at the grassroots level. And what you see is two very heavy extremes. On the left, which would be very, you don't find it too often, is still a certain herr pastor, you know, Achtung type of approach. And that is unacceptable. But growing in rapid, cancerous proportions among us is this fire and hire mindset on the part of the laity, where if they like a pastor, they hire him, and if they don't like him, they fire him, and that's the end of it. And that is not in harmony with the theology of the Scriptures or of our church body. Universal priesthood of all believers, as Martin Luther restored it to the church, you better believe it. But the doctrine of the call and the holy public pastoral ministry, we have cancerous growth developing among us, and we need as a church body clearly, concisely to address it and to do it now. Emphasis number six, a church body that is marked with full financial openness and reporting. For some reason or other, a lot of questions got started out there in the church as to the finances of the church. Whether it's congregational, district, or synod, we need to be a church body that lives in a financial glass house. And if some lady and some man want to come in and see the books of the president of the synod and know how the monies of the president's office are spent, they have every right to see it, because it's their church and their dollars and their mission and their ministry. We are not lords over the people of God. We are servants to the people of God. And we must reflect this in our budgeting. And finally, a church body that is marked with peace, harmony, restored unity in the Lord. At the Pittsburgh Convention, I said also to the people of God, I desire nothing more than to be a president of all the people, and I commit to you that under the Scriptures, I will work for peace, harmony, unity, and a restoration of peace among us. I pray God daily also that he would use me for that purpose. Not a blushing for the Scriptures, not a failure to deal with circumstances that arise among us in confessional practice and must be addressed, but at the same time a church body that is committed to a course of peace, unity, and harmony in Jesus Christ. And that emphasis I am also sounding from one end to the other of this great church. Well, that gives us about 25 or 24 minutes for questions and answers. I guess with that, I'd like to let you just kind of assume, is there microphones? Yeah, there are microphones here, and come up and ask the questions. No holds barred. If you got a sticky wicky one, let it fly. We'll try to answer it. If I don't have an answer, I'll tell you that too. But just ask the questions as you feel free. So who would like to jump into the pond first? All right, got somebody coming down? Very good. Maybe to save time, if there are others of you, I think already, feel free to come up to the microphones, and that way we will save time, get as many questions as possible. Yes.
Thank you. Robert Gable first-year student from Minneapolis.
All right.
A member of a Minnesota South District congregation, would like your comments on confessionalism as it's used as a label, as a movement within the church generally interpreted as conservative or ultra-conservative, and then specifically as it applies in my district with the Redeemer Burnsville situation. I know Lane Zeitz. I'm not familiar with the pastor involved. And you've been a district president. Obviously, this is not a good, comfortable situation, and yet it's a wonderful case study, a real, unfortunately, real-life case study on what do you do in a situation where you have valid reasons for one action, valid defenses on another, name-calling, labels. It's obviously gone quite far. Would simply like, I'm now also not aware of your involvement in it, if any, and simply please comment on this situation, as well as confessionalism as a label in the church today.
Well, let me begin by saying, picking up the confessionalism as a label. Lutheranism was also a label. Christianity was also a label. I don't mind labels. I will tell the church wherever I go that Al Berry is a conservative and a confessional Lutheran pastor and theologian, all right? I take pride in being that kind of a person. I recognize that to some people that will be a demeaning type of thing to say I'm a confessional Lutheran. I suppose to others it'll be a demeaning thing to say that I'm a conservative. But by the same token, I am proud of both of those handles because I think that's the kind of church body and theology that we have, and it's not a minus. I don't see it as barnacles, but as a flag. Now, with regard to taking that and using that as labels for political movements or what have you within the church, I think that that is unfortunate when that does happen, but by the same token, I suppose it also has happened in every other instance down through the years. I would hope that without getting caught up in the political maneuverings that always seem to be there, that there will be on the part of those who desire to be confessional, conservative Lutherans, a desire not to go in a negative route with this, but rather to see it in a positive light. And if someone happens to brand them the wrong way, to be very patient and understanding and kind about it. I might say that confessional Lutheranism is also not a hatchet. It is not an axe that should be applied in an axe-swinging manner. It needs, in all of our dealings with people, in all of our dealings with brother pastors, even when we differ with them and disagree, you use the word name-calling and labeling and that kind of stuff, totally inappropriate, whichever side of the fence it's on. So to me, the approach that I tried to use as a district president and I will try to use as a synodical president is I'm sure I'll have differences of opinion, but I will always try to sit down with the people with whom there is a difference of opinion and in the light of God's almighty word, deal with it, talk it out, keep talking it out, and working with it. So the labels, if they go negative, that's really too bad, but labels will always be there. Now with regard to the church at Burnsville, for those of you who are not acquainted with that, it's a congregation located immediately adjacent to the district office there, and I don't want to get in too deep on that one. You may want to visit with me more personally about it. It's a congregation where it is has about, as I understand it, a LCEF indebtedness of around $650,000, something like that. And the congregation has not been able to service that LCEF indebtedness. It looks like it may be a situation where the LCEF will be foreclosing on the congregation. You need to know that I have sat down and I have talked with the head of the LCEF saying, isn't there another way? Before God, there must be another way because every congregation will be hurt by that kind of foreclosure. So they're kind of caught between a rock and a hard spot. And in the process, somehow, the LCEF and the foreclosing aspect has been coupled to or interjected into some type of a feeling that this is because of a conservative theology versus a liberal theology and what have you. The LCEF people tell me the only reason they're working with this in this situation is because they've got a congregation that's grossly in arrears and they have no solution for it. I would hope we keep looking for a solution. Does that help a little? All right. Yes, sir.
Yes, Dr. Barrett, my name is Brian Leisman. I'm a fourth-year student. I'm from the Missouri District.
All right.
I enjoyed very much what you have said. I think it is a fresh re-emphasis on personal devotion and a nice direction for the church. But what I find maybe just lacking in this particular presentation, I find that you have not mentioned anything of the sacraments, and I'd like you to address that and how that fits into this goal that you have or proposed to set the LCMS in this direction.
Okay. I'm really glad you asked that question, because, and I must honestly admit, often when I make presentations, I will not say word and sacrament. And so fortunately, we have someone here who will bring that up to the surface again. Without a doubt, we as a church body have been fantastically blessed again with a clear understanding of the two sacraments, baptism and the Lord's Supper. And in the case of the latter, the frequency with which our people receive this great gift of God and the blessings of it, we need to encourage that again and again. And I guess maybe it's a faulty spot in my presentation when I'm talking about being in the Word in small groups or being in the Word and hearing it on Sunday morning. I, in my mind, am coupling together with it a heavy participation in the blessing of the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. And maybe I can get Al Berry re-taught to phrase it in such a way that when I say word and sacrament. But emphasis should definitely be there with all that that implies. That help?
Yes.
Thank you for bringing it up, though. All right?
Yes, my name is Rob Hermsett. I'm a first-year student here from Ohio District. And you had mentioned world missions,
yes.
And it is a sad affair that we reduced our staff of world missionaries. But I also like to have you address the issue of the United States being a mission field also.
All right. I guess I'd like to pick up a two-part. I'd like to make two questions out of your comments there. First, the world missions. Again, I don't know how we allowed ourselves to get in that downward nosedive, but we did. I recently was talking with the director of this of a conservative Presbyterian group, and he told me how many missionaries they had. I was talking with a Baptist, and he was telling how many, and he asked me how many we had, and I told him. And then he asked me, how many do you have at the International Center? And I told him 487. And he says, I think what you need to do is send half your staff overseas. I told him, no, I didn't think that was a solution. But what he was trying to say is that it's so easy to become administratively structured, and I feel we have to once again catch the joy of high priority in overseas missions. Now, missions within the United States. We do have a lot of overseas U.S. missions right in the United States. I was in the Pacific Southwest District out at Irvine College, and they took me on a tour of the multi-ethnic ministries there. And we went through Little Saigon, Little Cambodia, Little Vietnam, Little China, Big Hispania, you know. And it was just on and on and on. And what they were saying is, in this four-mile square, we have X number of people to whom we can reach out with the gospel. And so in some respects, and Dr. Ed Westcott was beginning to sound this, and you hear it also in Glen Oshoni, Glen Oshoni is the present mission executive. In many cases, God is bringing these ethnic groups right into our country where we can minister to them here. We don't have to go across the seas. To me, it's a both and, that we recognize them where they are here, but that we also go across the sea. You say, well, that's Los Angeles. That doesn't happen here in the Midwest. On the contrary, Storm Lake, Iowa. I don't know if anybody's from the western side of Iowa or not, but Storm Lake, Iowa has about 8,000 population in the community. And Storm Lake, Iowa, on the west side, it's in President Kepfer's district, now has 2,000 Laotians who have moved into Storm Lake. Now you talk about an opportunity for ministry. So, yes, both overseas with a lot of open doors, but also right within our own country. We got it both ways. Does that answer it? All right.
My question also deals with missions. And, you know, I'm encouraged by your emphasis on it, but I was wondering if you could please give us maybe a list of things that you would like to see your administration, the boards under you, do to encourage missions, a specific list. And are there any institutional barriers that we have to getting more people involved with missions work in the LCMS. Along with that, and then I'll shut up, a personal example that I was a little concerned about. This dealt with specifically OVYM, but I knew of a person in college that applied for that, a person that was well read in the Word, had a foundation in Greek and Hebrew. This person was not only highly recommended by myself, but also by more wiser people, people on the theology, the theological professors there at the college. But when this person went through some psychological analysis, they weren't allowed to go in to the OVYM. And I'm wondering, is that an institutional barrier? Are we depending more on pseudoscientific analysis of people rather than going to the Word and trusting in the Spirit's work in the church, in individual Christians?
All right. I'd like to pick, I heard really three questions. Overseas missions with the involvement of greater involvement perhaps in getting them over there on the part of the people. Then the institutional barriers and OVYM. I believe there are many new creative ways that we as a church body must explore in giving our people the joy of having overseas world missionaries. I would, for instance, be very much in favor of us moving in the direction of, instead of just the Synod calling someone to go overseas. Now we do it corporately. In other words, the Board for Missions, in behalf of the entire Synod, calls someone. I guess I'd like to see us do a little exploring as to whether we can allow districts to assume that responsibility cleared through the Board for Missions, so that the Missouri district could call a missionary to work in, always recognizing that it will not supervise the man, it will not train the man, but it will be directly responsible for the man, prayer-wise, word-wise, letter-wise, otherwise. And I think that would help personalize it. It would draw our people much closer to the mission program of the church, pretty much like you see with the Lutheran Bible translators. You recall how the Lutheran Bible translators work. They get their supporters. Now, we would not work it from the support angle, but they cluster and then they send across. So I think, yes, that can and should be done. It involves giving up a little bit of control, but if the gospel is getting out, who cares about giving up a little bit of control? Now, institutional barriers. I don't know exactly what you had in mind with institutional barriers. Were you thinking at... yes, please, just so I'm on target on the question.
Well, the question was, basically, are there any institutional barriers? One of them would be then the centralization of our missions work that you talked about, but also, my specific concern was some psychological analysis rather than, trusting in the wisdom of man rather than the wisdom of God.
Yeah. Institutional barriers. Undoubtedly, whenever you're involved in a program, whether it's overseas missions or wherever it may be, there's going to be an institutional structure that you're dealing with. And sometimes that institutional structure, I would hope many times that institutional structure would assist and abet the cause, but other times we all know that the institutional structure is going to thwart the cause. Hopefully it abets it more than it thwarts it. Where there are those places where people involved feel that the process is thwarting it, holding it back, restraining it, I think they need to really come up front and say, hey, the process is restraining us. It's not freeing us up to do the mission. We'll have to take a look at it again and what have you. And I would hope that those who are in the institutional structure, including Al Berry, would at that point genuinely listen and say, is there another way of doing it that is just as acceptable as the way we're presently doing it? But there will be. With regard to the psychological testing, undoubtedly I hear that on the Council of Presidents, even with regard to you seminarians. You know, should there be a battery of tests before a man is allowed to even get into the seminary? Should there be a battery of tests before he leaves the seminary and go out? One walks a very thin line at that point. There are two extremes. You can take that approach and, like you say, thwart the will of the Spirit. But to ignore that approach also could very easily set you up for a future psychological problem. So I guess it's one of those tough things in life where it's not a black or white issue. It's kind of a gray issue. And one dare not fall down on not using the expertise that's available to us. I'll use an example. You send a person overseas mission, you're going to sure check out his physical health before you send him overseas, because if he's got a physical problem, that going to Nigeria is going to really flare up. You want to know that. You got to use the expertise on the one side within bounds, but on the other side, you also have to trust that we all change under the guidance of God's Spirit as we move with word and sacrament into the future, and accommodate for that change, too. Does that answer? Okay. If I didn't get it, try at me again. Okay? All right.
Yeah, Dr. Berry, my question has to do with number five, but before I, or emphasis number five that you gave, but before I do that, just in responding to what we talked about previously, I'd like to implore you to continue to use psychological and scientific testing methods. I think they have a real place in the church. Enough said with that. Emphasis number five that you made, you kind of pointed to a tension, if you will, between the priesthood of all believers and the office of the public ministry. And you finished that section by saying that we need to do something about this.
All right.
Can you give us any specifics?
All right. At the Pittsburgh Convention, already prior to the Pittsburgh Convention, the Council of Presidents had initiated a study in this particular area. I don't know to what extent also we have turned to our seminary faculties and asked that they become heavily involved in these kinds of studies. I know as President of Synod, I'm going to be sending more requests to the synodical faculties to become involved and not just leave that in the hands of the CTCR. I think Dr. Johnson has already responded to one request that I have routed to the seminary here, and I would like to have the right to do more of that. But first of all, the Council of Presidents is addressing a study there. The Pittsburgh Convention is also talking about a study in this connection. But my concern is it's something that has to be a front burner issue, not something that we forever study and don't begin to come up with some very practical guidelines. We need to reemphasize to all of us the universal priesthood of all believers, so that as a pastor goes out, he recognizes that he has been entrusted the keys from the hands of the people into whom the keys were entrusted. You follow me? Handing the keys to them, and they now hand them to him. Kind of like I used the illustration, driving a car. If I hand my keys to you to drive my car, the ownership is still mine, but you now are using it. And so with the office of the keys, the ownership still remains with the congregation. But in the process, we have a lot of this tendency now to treat pastors as hired servants. And this is a putting down of the high office of the public pastoral ministry into which you have been called by God through his people. And I think the only way we're going to do it is not forever study it, but quickly get something out to the laity of the church, get something into the pastoral conferences, into the district conventions, where we talk about it and not in a us-them type of approach. We, they. But as the people of God studying it and saying, what's this great truth? What's this great truth? And we thank God for both. So it is in the process of being addressed, but I just hope it gets going faster. I see we have about 4 minutes. Is that correct? All right. We got time for another question here. Then maybe a few wrap-up remarks.
Mr. President, my name is Scott Seidler. I come out of the ELCA. And I am wondering what is the attitude of this synod in terms of ecumenism, because I've really come to appreciate the pure doctrine in terms of, you know, as opposed to what the ELCA is involved in right now. And I guess I'm concerned, you know, with the Lutheran Catholic dialogues and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What's the attitude of this synod in terms of ecumenism?
Ecumenism, all right. I think we have a document that the CTCR has put out that would be most helpful for you to study, and I would feel that that document is quite clear when it comes to what we as a church believe, teach, and confess in this particular area. Undoubtedly, on the one hand, we must always thank God for the Holy Christian Church and the communion of saints. When in the Creed we say, and I believe in the Holy Christian Church and the communion of saints, we need to say that with, thanks God, it is there. On the other side of the coin, we as a church, down through the years, have had some very excellent fellowshipping principles and fellowshipping guidelines that we as a church body have proclaimed and that we have followed. And this would be a case where now is not the time for us to become wishy-washy in what I feel are very good fellowship principles, but continue to respect those fellowship principles, to share them with those who are around us in a very positive manner, but at the same time also to not in any way to be ashamed of them or back away from them. So I will be all across this church saying the fellowship principles under which we in Missouri have operated during the early years of our life, middle years, later years, they're valid, they're good, and we should not be leaving them. All right? I have to tell you, in that connection, just maybe on a little lighter vein, with the Catholic Lutheran dialogue, we had, there were five bishops and one archbishop, and this meeting was scheduled before I ever got in St. Louis. Six bishops from the ELCA, and five of us from Missouri. Originally, there had only been two, and I added three more from Missouri. The sixth one became ill. But anyway, we even had a representative from the Vatican there, and his name was Archbishop Rodino. And coming into the International Center, meeting with us in the Walther Room, I thought that was interesting. Meeting with us in the Walther Room, Archbishop Rodino came up to me and he said, "I am Archbishop Rodino from the Vatican." And I said, "Well, I'm certainly happy to meet you. I'm Al Berry from St. Louis." And somehow I was trying to tell, you know, welcome. Glad you're here. We talked. It was a very, I would say it was not a heavy substance type of talk. It was just kind of, I felt we just kind of glazed over the top of the ice and never really got down into it. Now, I see our time is used up, and I want to do just one thing, and that is not just to wish to each of you a very blessed Christmas and Advent season in our Lord, but to tell you as seminarians who are preparing yourself for the office of the public pastoral ministry that it is still my feeling that the highest office in the church is not that of a district president or even the synodical president. The highest office in the church is still that of the man who has been asked by the people of God to serve them as a parish pastor. Prepare yourself well, then, that you might minister in word and sacrament, in love and people-centeredness, in faithfulness to the word, to the people of God. Love them mightily when you finally reach the parish. Be faithful to the word. Be out among them. And God will bless. Thanks for becoming future pastors in the Senate. Thank you.
We thank you, Dr. Berry, for being with us today, and we thank all of you for coming.